This is the Get Healthy 360 podcast, where we discuss topics related to your physical, mental, financial, and spiritual health. Your host is Dr. Chris Ferguson, board certified in anesthesiology and pain management. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and you should consult your primary health care provider before making any decisions related to your health. And here's your host, Dr. Chris Ferguson. Oh, one more thing before we start. If you like this episode, please consider rating us 5 stars. We would really appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Welcome again to Get Healthy 360. Today we're talking about pain medicine in Canada and the US. I'm interviewing Dr. Michael Wansbrough. He is a physician. He graduated from McMaster Medical School in Ontario, Canada. He completed a residency in family medicine at McGill University. He has an interest in international healthcare, which led him to a diploma in tropical medicine and a master's in communicable diseases epidemiology at the University of London and the London School of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. After doing research, he went on to work with the Canadian Network for International Surgery in East and West Africa. He went back to clinical medicine, completing a fellowship in emergency medicine at the University of Toronto. He's worked in rural and academic centers, as well as critical care transport physician. He's currently working at the University of Toronto as a pain physician and has numerous accolades. What we're talking about today is the differences in Canadian and American healthcare from a pain management specialist. For those who may not be familiar, I'm a pain specialist. I'm board certified in anesthesiology and pain management in the US. And Michael Wansbrough, he is a pain physician at the University of Toronto, medical director of their pain program. Michael, thank you very much for joining us on this podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. I just want to clarify the last part there. I'm a medical director at MedCan, chronic pain and recovery program, and I'm an assistant professor at University of Toronto, but I'm not their medical director at U of T.
Oh, I see. I apologize for that. You have many accolades. You've done a lot of fascinating things. But today we're focusing in on pain management differences in the U.S. versus Canada. So from your perspective, do you think there are differences in the epidemiology of chronic pain in the U.S. versus Canada?
So there's a lot of similarities and differences. It's interesting that in Canada, similar to the United States, we have 1 in 5 people who are in chronic pain and 1 in 3 over 65 years old of chronic pain. In the U.S., it's fairly similar, I believe. However, I ran across a geographic study which looked at the differences between Canada and the U.S. and chronic pain. And apparently, you guys have more chronic pain per capita. And it's related to certain hotspots, such as the South and Appalachia and the West, like Oregon, apparently has higher incidences of chronic pain. And they tend to relate that to lower socioeconomic challenges in those communities. We as well have differences across Canada. Some provinces have more chronic pain than others. So, and it's also related often to socioeconomic issues. So that was pretty interesting.
I think it'd be hard to argue that, unfortunately, as someone is on that lower socioeconomic tier, it's easy to see that they're more stressed. They have less access to resources. They're probably not eating good food. They don't have time to exercise, which just leads into the whole chronic pain, poor health spiral, downward spiral.
Exactly. And that's all just, of course, become aggravated due to the whole COVID crisis, right? With less access to those swimming pools where they're doing their AquaFit and gyms and their physiotherapy sessions or physical therapy, say there. And other restrictions have aggravated a lot of this chronic pain crisis that we're already in.
How was it over? So right now it's the summer of 2022. How was it really at the peak of the COVID crisis in Toronto, when you think of Toronto, think of Toronto like you think of New York, very dense population, lots of apartments. And if everyone's social distancing and you're just staying in this little tiny apartment, how do you really get exercise or get out to do anything? How did you cope because you're in Toronto?
Well, fortunately, I was able to go to the clinic every day and drive along this very barren highways, which was amazing in the sense that one of the benefits of COVID was driving down the freeway that was normally wall to wall with traffic, and I could actually put cruise control on and get to the clinic. But a lot of people were stuck in their houses, of course, and who I would see at the clinic would be patients for whom that would be like their one outing that month would be to come and see me. They were just, some of the family would discourage them from leaving their apartments, getting in the elevators. And so it was part pain visit and part social visit for a lot of these, especially the elderly people. So there's a lot of isolation, and their health I could see deteriorate over the last 2 years with their, again, inability to access their usual support structures, their pools, the gyms, their physios. Their family doctors' offices were mostly closed. They were doing Zoom calls, and they were just stuck at home.
And then what kind of food were they eating? Were people able to go to the grocery store and get fresh food, or were they really just stuck at home getting fast food or takeout?
I think Uber Eats had a real boom during this time. People would go to the grocery stores. We'd have masks, and there would be lineups. There was a quota for how many people were allowed in the grocery store at a time. So it wasn't unusual to go to your usual place and have to wait in line for half an hour. And I felt like I was in the Soviet Union, you know, in the 70s. But eventually you get in there and everybody's looking at each other with suspicion and keeping away if there was a sneeze. Or it was a bizarre experience, wasn't it? Just going to the grocery store. But there was food. There was, you know, initially, I think just like in your area, there was a lack of toilet paper and other sort of essential items were ransacked, and people were charged with hoarding and then trying to sell it at an elevated price. So it was a really bizarre time. And fortunately, we're pretty much on the back end of that now. There's still people who are masking, which they're doing voluntarily. There's no mask mandates anymore in the city or even on public transport. But things seem to be improving tremendously, and people are coming out again. Pools are opening. Aquafit classes are started back up again. And the sun is shining, so hopefully we won't get another wave. I mean, we're sort of just past the peak of this last wave, according to wastewater and hospital data. So that's all very positive at this point.
I agree. In the U.S., it seems like we're coming out of the COVID panic. Everyone seems to be moving forward with their lives. The other epidemiology issue in the U.S. and Canada is chronic pain management. In the U.S., it's a very hot topic right now. Is the CDC guidelines are coming out again, and they're revamping their guidelines regarding who should and who should not have access to chronic pain medication. So if you're not in chronic pain and you don't know anyone in chronic pain, this is probably not an important issue for you. But if someone has a chronic, just non-cancer pain, or they have active cancer, or they have had cancer and have pain as a result like that of that condition, or they have sickle cell or diabetic neuropathy or a whole host of other conditions that cause chronic pain issues. There's arguments on both sides about how much access people should have to being on chronic opioid medication. How is that viewed in Canada? Do you have your own guidelines? Do you follow the US guidelines? How does that work?
We have our own guidelines that were created in 2017, spearheaded by the DeGroote School of Medicine, which is McMaster University in Hamilton, and they have a big chronic pain program. And so we follow the guidelines issued by them, which are very similar to your CDC guidelines. There's a few differences. For example, the Canadian guidelines recommend the use of long-acting opiates, whereas the CDC recommends against using them. And the other difference was that if you have a substance use disorder, we recommend against using any opiates, whereas the CDC recommends,
medical assisted treatment. So in the form of Suboxone or Methadone.
Right. And then you could use that. So mm-hmm. Those were the two differences, but very similar guidelines.
So if I say I had chronic knee pain for whatever reason, I have chronic knee pain and I went to my family practice doctor in Canada, Ontario, to be specific. And I said, I want to take, let's just say, hydrocodone 3 times a day. How hard would that be to get?
It would be hard because there's a real movement away from prescribing opiates in general, mm-hmm. especially if you haven't gone through the usual NSAIDs and Tylenol and the pyramid. So opiates would be more at the top of the pyramid. You have to try these other ones first. And the physical rehab and all these strategies. And, if worse comes to worse, nothing's working, then it might be considered. But I don't really, very few patients of mine I put on opiates, because most of them do okay with their physical rehab. And if they can take anti-inflammatories, which a lot of people, of course, can't because they're elderly with all kinds of contraindications. And Tylenol is not a terrific medication. Acetaminophen, it's more for fever than for pain. Then it's sort of a very last ditch scenario, prescribing opiates. And I think it's just really not a thing that people generally go to anymore.
Just to digress before we get into different treatment availability and different treatment patterns, how does someone become a pain physician in Canada? Can anyone be a pain physician? Is it a specific specialty? So, for example, in the US, the pathway is you have some sort of undergrad degree, you go to medical school, you finish medical school, then you do a residency in either typically anesthesiology, but sometimes neurologists or physical medicine rehab doctors do it, do those residencies. And then after that residency, you do a subspecialty year in just pain management. So you can be boarded in, say, anesthesiology, physical medicine, rehab, neurology, or some other specialties. Sometimes psychiatrists will do it. And then you do an extra year of doing pain. And then you can be a board certified pain physician. Of course, some people may be non board certified pain physicians prescribing or doing some courses, but really to be a board certified pain physician, you need to do the full fellowship. And then you would offer the assorted medications and procedures that a pain physician does. How does that work in Canada?
So can I just ask you, can a family doctor go finish their family medicine program in the States and then do an extra year of pain? And
I might be wrong on this. I'm not totally sure, but I think you need a minimum of 4 years of residency training in order to do the fellowship. As far as I know, I might be wrong on that, but I'm not aware of any family practice doctors that have done the full fellowship.
Right.
I might be wrong on that.
Right. Okay. Well, in Canada, basically there's two streams traditionally. There's the College of Family Physicians of Canada, which is a 2-year residency program that you, after medical school, and you become a family doctor. And that group has a plus 1 year at the end for special interests like emergency medicine, and there's actually an anesthesia components. You can work in the hospital and do surgeries. and sports medicine, for example.
So wait, as a quick question then, just because I did an anesthesia residency, which was 4 years of training. So someone in Canada can do 2 years of family practice, 1 year of anesthesia, and then go do anesthesia?
Correct. Yeah.
That's really different.
Maybe they're overtraining you guys. I don't know.
Maybe they're overtraining us in the US.
One of my friends did that route, and she works in a small hospital in Owen Sound, which is in the shores of Lake Huron, Georgian Bay. And so she did the two years of family medicine and then 1 year anesthesia. And then there she goes.
So, but then you also have full, this is a really large digression, but okay. So wait, there are also anesthesia residency programs.
Yes. So this is not to be confused with the Royal College side of things. So you have the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada, and they're responsible for all the other specialties. So internal medicine, and then the subspecialties of internal medicine, anesthesia, general surgery, and all their subspecialties, et cetera. So now this is up until 2020, you could be trained in family medicine, emergency medicine. There's also two emergency medicine streams. So there's the family medicine with emergency medicine fellowship at the end. And then there's the Royal College Emergency Medicine, which is a 5-year program. So most of the Royal College programs are 5 years. And so if you were before 2020, you could go into pain medicine from the family medicine side of things by retraining having a supervisor and a practice plan in terms of educational outcomes plan. And you had to submit this training plan to the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario. I'm just talking about Ontario here. And then after 2 years and a certain number of hours, you would be assessed by another pain doctor would come and see you practice and go through your charts and watch you do your interventions. And then if that outcome was okay, then you can have a designated practice in chronic interventional pain management. And that's basically the route that I took. The other route so that was shut down in 2020 because in 2010 the Royal College took over the chronic pain training and added it as a 2-year fellowship at the end of any one of the multiple Royal College programs. There's a few exceptions to that, but that didn't really get going until 2014. And so the first class graduated in 2016, as first grads. So after 2020, the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario decided that they were going to shut down the other pathway because the anesthesia group was now taking the umbrella parenting role of the chronic pain program. And so now basically the only way to get into chronic pain is through a Royal College certified program with a 2-year chronic pain fellowship. And that's how it's going right now. But the problem with that now is that there's the funding for the chronic pain fellowship positions is taken from the university's allotment. So they have to decide to create positions and they have to take away that money from somewhere else. So there's a bit of a challenge with funding graduates out of that stream. So we're still not seeing enough chronic pain physicians for the demand that we have. It's kind of complicated. Does that sort of paint a picture in a way of how it's working?
It does. That helps clarify it. So there's been a modification. So it sounds like you would go through one of those subspecialties through the Royal College in Canada, and then you do a 2-year fellowship just in pain.
That's right. So you can, a lot of anesthesia grads would then do their 2-year fellowship, or if you're in emergency through the Royal College program, you could do the 2-year program, 2-year fellowship. If you're internal medicine or rheumatology or physical medicine and rehab, then you can go through that 2-year fellowship program. That whole journey and the two different streams, did that make sense, or should I explain that again?
No, it makes sense. So you had a certain pathway in the past, and now you have a different pathway. But does that mean that everyone that was a pain physician before get grandfathered in?
Right. So I can tell you, like, my journey was sort of in the former, where I had been working in emergency medicine for 20 years. And we do a lot of ultrasound guided procedure, of course, in emergency. But I got drawn into the chronic pain side of things. And what I did was a bunch of courses on chronic pain and image guided procedures. So there's the ICERA, International Society of Ultrasound. ICERA is a long acronym. What do they stand for? But so there's ultrasound courses on interventional procedures. So I did several of those, and then I wrote the certified interventional pain sinology exam in Miami a few years ago, and that's organized through the World Association of Pain Management and Ultrasonography. So that was my course, and I can tell you the landscape now. There's basically three groups practicing pain. So there's the grandfathered group, who were a lot of family doctors who got interested in pain management, and they are working in community pain clinics. And there's two groups of those. There's one group that uses ultrasound guidance, image guidance, and there's the other group that doesn't like to use image guidance because it wasn't part of their practice plan. They don't have familiarity with it, and it's created a lot of tension with the government and the anesthesiology group. And in general, because there's a lot of politics involved and patient care issues, and then you have the anesthesia group, who work primarily in the hospitals but often have work in clinics as well and see patients. So there's these three groups, and we have the pain. The Ontario Medical Association has a pain group, pain focus group, and it's dominated by the grandfathered pain doctors, and they promote our interests with the government and with the College of Physician Surgeons of Ontario. There's been a lot of rumblings over the last few years of trying to change the regulations that all procedures should be image guided, and some can be ultrasound guided and some should be fluoroscopically guided, which would of course ruffle a lot of feathers with this group that doesn't use ultrasound at all or any image guidance. And the concern is that there's just been a lot of billing for nerve blocks, which it's kind of hard to understand how the physician can call it a nerve block when they really aren't sure.
We're getting into some really technical medical jargon. So just to digress for anyone who isn't a pain physician, this is what we're talking about. Let me correct me if I'm not summarizing properly. So in the US, in order to bill for nerve procedures, typically it's done with something called fluoroscopy guidance. You have an X-ray and you put the needle wherever you want to put it. And there's clear imaging that needle is where it's supposed to be, with a bunch of views, And anyone could objectively look at it and say, that's done properly. And what Dr. Wansborough is saying is that in Canada, some people use imaging, some people don't, and some people use ultrasound, which is basically sound waves. So you can see in live motion where the needle is, or you can use, some people will use fluoroscopy, which is a live x-ray. And there's a movement, correct me if I'm wrong, in Canada where some physicians want to move towards image guidance so you can see where the needle's going. Now, from my perspective, it seems odd that you wouldn't just learn how to do it with image guidance, because otherwise you're poking someone with a needle and you really don't know where that needle is. So if you're doing a simple injection in someone's back, what I would call a trigger point injection, because you don't really know where it is, you're just injecting into the muscle. If you go too deep or the needle has a misadventure and it goes somewhere it's not supposed to go, then you could end up, say, puncturing their lung, and that would be bad because they have a punctured lung.
That's not good.
They would need a chest tube and all sorts of other bad complications. So it would be really odd for me to call something a nerve block unless you have image guidance, because how do you know where that needle is? It could be anywhere.
Right. Well, I don't even understand, you know, what the nerve is that they're blocking when they're doing those injections.
So I don't really know how that argument is made. It makes no sense to me.
Right. But they're very protective of the status quo. They see patients often every week or two. They inject local anesthetic, so like lidocaine or bupivacaine, marcaine, which lasts really a day or two at the most. And then they bring the patients back and then they do it all over again. And of course, the government gets really irritated with this because they have to pay. Canada's, as you know, is a publicly funded system. So that everybody is covered by the government insurance plan, and the physicians just bill the government, and the government generally just pays. And there are certain rules around payments, including how many nerve blocks you can do at a session, but not the number per month, for example. So they're really trying to be a little bit more judicious with the spending and with trying to make sure that there's patient safety issues and that procedures are being done appropriately. I wouldn't know, like, doing a facet injection in a back, which is a structure in the back of the spine, and you have to see it. You can't just sort of put a needle in the back and hope for the best.
Well, how could you bill? So there's this little joint in the back called the facet, which joins the two, the bones in your back. How could you call it a facet injection unless you have image guidance? You have no idea where that is.
Right. Exactly.
And so I don't know how you, like, I don't need that. That's not even possible.
Yeah, it really, and I know there's going to be some listeners out there who are going to be really annoyed with what I'm saying. Because I've mentioned this before in emails to the pain groups about we should be using ultrasound guided procedures, and that got shut down very quickly. So this is the geography of the politics that we're dealing with right now.
Well, I think it would be an easy fix, because I would say you put the needle where you think it's supposed to be, and then I'll image it, and then we'll see where it actually is, and then it'll answer the question really quickly. Do you know where that needle is or not? And then you just image it, and then you will see it's probably not where you think it is.
Well, on the other side of the equation is there are, as you know, thousands of patients in chronic pain, but they have nowhere to go. The interventional pain clinics at the universities that are multidisciplinary often have a year wait, and some in a recent study showed that up to 42 months wait in one province. The average wait's about eight months to a year to get in to see somebody.
I have a relative in Canada that I tried to send to the University of Toronto, or really just a pain clinic in Toronto, and it was a year wait list for any pain clinic.
Yeah, it's and then once you get into the pain clinic, for example, I had a patient with chronic regional pain syndrome, which is a terrible burning pain in her arm that's with swelling, and she really needed not just somebody to prescribe medication. She needed a psychologist, a pain psychologist. She needed physical rehab, maybe interventional management. She needed a multidisciplinary clinic, nutritional managed support, all kinds of things. I sent her to our interventional pain clinic in Toronto, and she was triaged, sent to the neurologist. So the neurologist in this part of this program saw her, said, "I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do for you," and sent her home. There was no multidisciplinary communication at all. And it was just so frustrating. And then I had to try to get her back into this pain clinic. And they said, "Well, she's already been referred to the pain clinic, so she doesn't need to be re-referred." And it just goes around in circles.
So this is something I think that when people discuss, and I think there are merits to both systems. So I'm not, before we launch into this topic, I think there's merits to both systems, and there are lessons to be learned from both systems on both sides. So the condition that that Dr. Wandsworth is discussing is something, again, I'll reiterate this, it's called complex regional pain syndrome. If you Google it, it'll come up on Wikipedia as the suicide disease, because it's really horrible pain that you can get after a very minor trauma or surgery. And it's really, really horrible. And I can't think of anything worse, knowing that you have this disease, you have a diagnosis, and you just can't get treated. And from my understanding, if I wanted to come to Canada and be a pain physician, it'd be a really complicated process, assuming I could even get hired, because there are no jobs for me in Ontario.
Right. It's very challenging. So we're going back to the community pain clinics. Mm-hmm. They're servicing a group of patients who have no alternatives. They can't get into these interventional pain. It's a long wait to get into image-guided, multidisciplinary pain clinics. So they get some temporary relief with their anesthetic injections, and then they just keep coming. The other problem is they can't get physical rehab. It's not covered for most people. And pain psychology is not covered. So they have to pay out of pocket for those two critical services. In an ideal world, we would do an injection with some cortisone, brings the pain levels down. Yes, it lasts a month or two. But that's the time when they are now empowered to get on with a physical rehab program and make some progress and see the pain psychologist, and their pain levels are lower, so they can focus on these issues. But the patients come back to me and they say, "Well, yeah, are you doing physio? Nope, can't afford it. Are you seeing a pain psychologist? Nope, don't believe in it and can't afford it anyway. Have you seen a nutritionist? Nah, can't afford it." So they keep in this endless circle of coming back and having injections, and it's very frustrating. What we need is a system that's funded where we can have these other services and complement interventional management with a holistic approach with nutrition, pain psychology, physical rehab. I mean, those are the critical things, but it's just a real gap in our service right now.
So here's something that I became aware of that I don't think many people are aware of, is I don't know about the other provinces, but if Ontario pays for a service, so like, let's say you have complex regional pain syndrome, it's horrible pain, and you can't get into the University of Toronto. I think you know where I'm going to go with this. And let's say I wanted, for a variety of reasons, to move back to Ontario, and I'm going to open my own private pain clinic. And I will say, I'm not going to charge the taxpayers anything. I'm just going to open up for cash service. I'm going to offer physical therapy, behavioral health, nutrition, and interventions as needed. And this patient would say, "You know what? I can afford it and I want to get better. I'm going to go to that pain clinic." And the Ontario government will say, "Nope, that's illegal, because I pay for something. You can't charge people money for it."
Yeah, it's supposed to be providing health for all, but really under the model, it's leaving thousands of patients with no health service at all. So there was a recent in Vancouver, a doctor was a surgeon was trying to do a private clinic on the side, and he was taken to court and went to the Supreme Court, and just last month was ruled against that you cannot have a parallel private system when there's a government funded system. And his argument was, yes, but the government funded system, the wait times are way too long. People with cancers and so on are languishing, and what was once maybe a curable condition is now incurable because of the wait times. So this is not providing health for all, but he lost his argument.
So here's a really specific case. There's a procedure called a celiac plexus ablation or splanchnic nerve ablation. So this procedure works phenomenally well. If someone has terminal, let's say pancreatic cancer, they're dying and they're in horrible pain, and you can give them all the pain medication in the world, probably not going to work really well because of doneness. But if you put some alcohol around the nerves called the celiac plexus, or also known as the splanchnic nerves, these little nerves that form the celiac plexus, it's often immediate, 100% relief, works really well. I'm just picturing this patient, if they just find the right pain doctor that does it, which are not that rare. You find the pain doctor in the US, you say, this is my diagnosis. I have terminal cancer. I want to be comfortable. You do the block. I've never had this block denied by insurance. You do the block, works really well, really, really, really well. Patient's happy, family's happy, everyone's happy. I'm just thinking about Canada, just to get an appointment, let alone get someone to even do this procedure. I don't see that happening. And even if you want to pay for it in Canada, you can't, which is insane to me from the US system.
No,
maybe it makes sense to Canadians.
You have to fly to the US or some other country. So in response, actually, this is a good segue, because in response to actually to the opiate crisis, and this is before COVID in about 2017, there was a realization that there was a massive chronic pain issue, and that there wasn't enough services. There weren't enough interventional pain clinics multidisciplinary pain clinics that were able to manage people's pain. So there, what was the alternative? It was opiates. And the opiate epidemic was out of control, still is. So they set up a task force with the Minister of Health and stakeholders, created the Canadian Pain Task Force. And they met, they created three different papers with ideas. And the last paper resulted in a pain action plan, a national federal pain action plan that is quite a document full of the right political speak and all the stakeholders and all the different communities and so on. So there's a lot of talk about the importance of this, and there's a website called Pain Canada that came out of this. And you can Google the paincanada.ca, and it's an interesting website. And so I went on it, and it said, you know, any questions? So I decided to ask a question. I said, so I've got this pain patient community who have no funding for everything they need. They need a physical rehab. They need pain psychology. They need nutritional support. So when am I going to see any action happening on helping my patients, on the ground here? And I haven't heard back from them yet, but you know, it would be good to have some support for some of these services. And hopefully we're going to go in that direction.
But it's still, so I think funding is important. I think the good thing about Canada is that no one, at least in Ontario, correct me if I'm wrong, is that no one's going bankrupt with medical bills.
Right. That's a good thing.
So you're not going to the doctor and you get all these medical bills and you can't pay them and then you lose your house, and then that's a problem. But you kind of get what you pay for, which is why you get these long lines. But it's still interesting to me that people aren't pushing for that payer system, because you still need the safety net, but if you have the means, you should be able to at least pay for it, because that would unburden the public system, because at least some of those patients would shift.
No, that's the usual argument. But especially now when there is such a barrier to accessing healthcare here. There's one in two nurses are retiring or quitting in, mm-hmm. in the next year. COVID-related burnout and bad planning by the government. There was this bill, it's called Bill 124, kind of boring thing, but they limited raises for nurses to 1% per year. And that was in 2019. And nurses started saying, this isn't worth it, and started leaving their profession for other things, or working in private, or working in clinics. So we have a crisis in nursing and in doctors, but to the point where emergency departments over the last few months have been shutting down for weekends. Last weekend, there was like 20 emergency departments that shut down temporarily because of lack of nursing, and ICUs in Toronto were on critical bed alerts, which means that there wasn't enough staff to cover the beds in a safe way, and including the Hospital for Sick Kids. Their ICU was in a critical bed alert. So we're just facing this terrible crisis over the last few months that was there before COVID, but now it's really at a head. I got an email today begging, sent out to doctors who work in the North, and I've worked in the North a bunch of times. So they're begging us to go up to work in this community up north, paying us about three or four times what we would normally be paid per hour just to go and cover that emergency department for 24 hours. It's going to shut down. And once it shuts down, then patients have to fly. Or this place, Cochrane, is 2 hours from Timmins. Anyway, it's and then the Timmins emergency department becomes overwhelmed because all those patients are going there. The same in Ottawa. There's hospitals closing their emergencies over the last few weeks, and then they have to go to the other emergencies and overwhelm them. So it's a really bad situation right now.
So, but I still can't get my head around why they wouldn't allow a private system. I can't really think of I can't really think of a good argument why you wouldn't.
Well, the argument is that doctors would want to go to work in the private system. They get more money, and then there's no doctors to working in the public system, and then the people who can't afford it are a disadvantage, right? That's the usual.
But then the market forces should balance it out, because people would only pay so much, but if the government paid what doctors should get paid, because that's what people are willing to pay for it, then it would really set the pay for the doctors, because if this is what the private sector is willing to pay for it, then the public sector should be somewhat close to it.
Well, I'm not an economist, but it sounds like a rational argument to me.
I'm just thinking of, let's just say you're in Canada, Ontario, you're dying of pancreatic cancer. Someone you love is dying of pancreatic cancer. I don't know how many people you've seen with this, but it is a really, really bad way to go. And there's a simple procedure. I'm injecting, say, alcohol. Alcohol is really cheap. It's like pure alcohol. It's super cheap. It's just alcohol. It's nothing magic about it. And you just put it in the right spot and it works really well right away. But you, with like some x-ray and a needle, which is not expensive.
Well, there's a triage system. So for example, at the Toronto Academic Pain Management Institute, which is the big hospitals in Toronto, mm-hmm. have gathered together all their pain clinics, and you send one referral to a central intake, and they would decide the urgency of your request. And I hope it would be in my hope that somebody like you're talking about would be triaged more urgent and would be seen faster than somebody else who would be less urgent. So there is a triaging system there. But I don't know. I honestly don't know what to.
But if someone has, say, complex regional pain syndrome, they can be seen pretty quickly and they can get a full like physical therapy, behavioral health, procedures as needed, medications as needed. But on the flip side, but the downside to the US system is if you don't have insurance, then you have to pay for it, which is, if you don't have insurance, prohibitively expensive. If you don't have insurance and you don't have the funds to pay for it, so then you get nothing.
Right.
And if you can pay for it, every insurance is different. You have this very large bill that you have to deal with. So there's a downside to the US system.
Yeah. Well, we've been very proud as Canadians to have the system that we have with universal healthcare. And it's one of those things that we feel makes us Canadian, makes us who we are, is this sort of, we care for everybody. We want to care for everybody and care for everybody equally. And it's really only been over the last decade or so with government cutbacks and closing beds and bad decisions that we have hit this serious crunch that's just been exacerbated by the whole COVID crisis. And I don't know, we'll have to see what's going to happen over the next 6 months to a year, because these hospitals are closing, the emergency departments are closing down, and nurses are leaving, and it's a real problem. So the politicians are saying the right things in the camera, but I don't think they're really quite getting it. So we'll see. Yeah.
What do Canadian physicians, what's the perception of US healthcare in Canada?
Well, you can get your test done tomorrow. I mean, you want an MRI, you get it done tomorrow, right? If you have insurance, you don't have to wait for 2 or 3 months. So in Canada, if you want an MRI, it's not an emergency. Then you usually wait 2 or 3 months to get your MRI. I always tell my patients to call and get put on a cancellation list, and maybe they'll get one at 4 a.m. somewhere. But the U.S., you need something done. It's done quickly, but it's expensive, right? So it terrifies us. We see those hospital bills that we hear about, and it's just unbelievable. The other impression that I have is that it's more aggressive. Right. So it seems like there's more interventions, there's more early adopting of technology, and not always for the right reasons. Right. So in a publicly funded system, for example, take spinal cord stimulators. We have a certain limited budget in each province to install. And a spinal cord stimulator, why don't you explain what a spinal cord stimulator is? Because that's technical again.
So spinal cord stimulators, if you have, say, complex regional pain syndrome, this nerve condition, or you have, say, you've had spine surgery and you have severe back pain, and you've tried physical therapy, behavioral health, maybe you've tried some steroid injections or other sort of things, and it's not helping. The process is you see a psychologist, you have to get approved, and then you have a trial. So you try it for a week to see if it's helping with your pain. And then if it's helping you with your pain, meaning at least 50% pain relief and some sort of functional improvement, then it would get implanted, meaning these two little catheters would go in your back, kind of like a labor epidural, and a little battery that would then power that to help you with your pain. Is it perfect? No, there are risks with the procedure. Like any sort of spine surgery, there's always risks. But if you're living in debilitating pain from a nerve condition, then it's a good option. But it's, the technology has come a long way. I think they work really well. Now, I know of physicians in the US that, like an individual physician, not me, but other physicians, that will do probably a couple hundred of these a year.
So to put that in context, at one of the major hospitals in Toronto, they have a budget for 40 or 50 a year. And so they have to be very careful about who they put them into. And as you said, there's a trial phase where they see if it actually works, a temporary one. And when it's a publicly funded system, this is from the UK, this information that I'm, but it would be very similar in Canada, I would imagine. They're much more cautious about choosing the right patient for the who will likely benefit from it. And the ratio of trials to success is higher when it's publicly funded than it is when it's not publicly funded, because you have more freedom. You can just try it on a much larger range of people. Mm-hmm. So the statistics I was just hearing about was 30% or 40% positive trial rate in the US versus something like 60 to 70% in the UK. So that's a bit of a difference in between publicly funded and private healthcare. Right? You can be more aggressive. Maybe there's financial issues for compensation. What do you think of that?
I think it's a hard thing to balance, because you can either, it depends on what you're optimizing for. If you're optimizing for cost effectiveness, then you want only a few people. If you choose only perfect candidates, your outcomes are going to be really good. But there are going to be some people that could be good candidates that never have access to the technology. So if you're optimizing for cost, that's a better way to go. If you're optimizing to help the most number of people, well, then you trial more people and you give more people access to the technology, but then you're going to have more failure. So it depends on just what you're optimizing for.
Right. And we're very, you know, we have very precious few of these things, right? So even though it's been shown that they save money in the long term, I mean, these things cost $20,000, $30,000 per device. And then there's yearly costs to them, right? So, but they do save money in the right people over time. So I think that's a bit of a difference. And again, the other difference is if you don't have money in the U.S., you don't have insurance, then you're in a really difficult situation, right? You have Medicare and Medicaid, but if I was somebody on Medicare. Which one's the elderly one?
Medicare is the elderly one. So if you're elderly and you have Medicare, then as long as your insurance takes Medicare, then you're fine. I think, and if you have no money, then you're on Medicaid, and then right. That's fine, assuming you go to somewhere that takes Medicaid. The hard part is where you're working, so you don't qualify. You're in this, like, you make an income that isn't enough for you to really afford to pay for it, but you're making too much to qualify for Medicaid. You're in this like middle, you're like this working poor.
Right. And you're not likely going to get a spinal cord stimulator.
Probably not.
Right.
So that's the upside of in Ontario. And then you have a bill and you have this like large bill you have to contend with.
Right. Right. I remember working in Hawaii as an elective and a medical student. I know that sounds like a terrible, terrible elective in an emergency department. I just couldn't believe that every time an IV bag was hung on a patient, there was a sticker, a barcode sticker that was then applied to the chart that they were going to actually, this is like a charge. So everything was barcoded and put on the chart. And it was just such a different.
So
different,
there's the submitted. So there's the things that are charged. So there's a submitted charge to the insurance, but then the insurance will just decide, well, we're charging you $100 for that IV bag, we're just going to give you 10 because that's what we feel like giving you. And that's just how it goes.
Right. Right. So from that perspective, I feel lucky being able to bill the government, because there's the rules are there. We know
it's more straightforward.
Yeah, it's very straightforward.
There's a whole billing industry there's a whole department in the hospital just to bill all these hundreds of insurance companies.
Right.
And figuring out which insurance company will cover what. And sometimes the rules for how to do things will vary from different insurances. So there's a whole extra cost there with these insurances.
Yeah, my head's spinning already.
It's messy. But we've been on this call for almost an hour now and we're running out of time. So any closing thoughts on pain management, US versus Canada?
Yeah, I think we have some hope here in the sense that we have this Canadian Pain Task Force that's resulted in the Canada paincanada.ca and there's a real focus on the government to try and fix this chronic pain problem that we're facing. So there's hope, and it's federally run, and that is different from the U.S. where it's quite partitioned you have the CDC with the opiate guidelines, but I don't see a national chronic pain strategy to try and tackle the problem there. So that's, I mean, unless I'm wrong about that, but that's a hopeful side of things in Canada. And but right now we're in a real crisis, as I was explaining, with lack of staff and shortages of beds and lack of access. So I'm hoping that we will come out of this. We have no private access to healthcare, so this is what we're stuck with unless you're wealthy and you can fly to Germany or US to get your thing done. And this is where we're at right now. In terms of training, I think it's a good route that we're on with the pain fellowship, and hopefully we can get more image guidance out in the community pain clinics. And that's pretty much, those are my closing thoughts. Thank you for having me on this
show. Thank you very much for taking the time. And I think I really enjoyed the conversation of differences in the US and Canada. Again, I think there are benefits to both systems, and both systems could learn from each other to really optimize for really patient outcomes, which is why we're all here.
Absolutely.
Dr. Wandsborough, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and visit the Get Healthy 360 Facebook page. We are always looking for feedback and new story ideas. Thanks again, and see you next time.